Okay, y'all, we just waded through a whole lot of heavy in our extended conversation on misinformation. So now let's get offline. How about a little trip to the theater? Thanks for the program. Excuse me, thanks. Whew, okay, you found your seat? Got your mask secured? Phone silenced? Now shh, lights are going down. Curtains coming up. Are you comfortable? Well, then I sure hope you bought a ticket for Wicked or The Lion King or even To Kill a Mockingbird. Because if your stub says slave play, there's really no point in settling in because in a few moments, you are not going to be feeling so comfortable at all. The edgy, seat-squirming, mild distress about to overtake you is exactly what playwright Jeremy O'Harris wants.
When I start talking about these things, it's going to create a ruckus. And that's just because that's my nature. I've always been that. I'm a Gemini. I'm a double Gemini, Taurus, Moon. So that means I'm also stubborn. So like I'll say chaotic things and then like cause a fire and then stubbornly stand by the positions I've given to everyone around me. So I think that like the sort of that part of the fraught nature, the sort of like racial tensions that arise from the play or the sort of like emotional tensions that arise from like what it means to have these conversations in open, I was used to.
Now, Harris is best known as the writer behind the Tony-nominated Slave Play. It's a comedy that follows three interracial couples attempting to work through relationship issues by doing antebellum South sexual role play. And it's a show that asks very messy questions around race and sexuality. Slave Play ended its initial run on Broadway several months before the pandemic shut the entire theater world down. And this month, it's back on Broadway and guaranteed to upend expectations for a whole new audience.
I mean, I have so many conflicted feelings about bringing anything back for a group of people to, you know, sit in one room together and witness, right? That sense of sitting in a community with other people is so fraught right now. And it's something I think we're all getting our sea legs about. But I feel so much exhilaration when I start thinking about what it does mean that I get to do this play once again, a play I thought, A, would never go to Broadway in the first place, but now it's going back for the second time, this time with an audience seeing it with new eyes. There's a real exhilaration about that.
I spoke with Jeremy O'Harris about Slave Play's return to Broadway and why audience discomfort is so important for his work.
I wanted to situate an audience, a brown audience, a black audience, a white audience, a queer audience, inside of my psyche, right? Like, I don't see the work of being a playwright, my own work of being a playwright, as a work of anything other than like inviting people who are not me to see the world through my eyes, through see my nightmares, see my dreams. And so I wanted the world that came to this play, the people that came to this play, to like live with the discomfort I've lived with as someone who's like had like a litany of like mental illnesses that were undiagnosed for most of my childhood and have had to grow up as a 6'5" black gay man for most of my life, making people uncomfortable and feeling uncomfortable in the presences of all of the institutions I was a part of. And so much of the work of the play is me creating images that I'm very comfortable with because I've lived with these images in a litany of ways for many years. And like present them to people and not letting them off the hook because I want them to walk through Slave Play the way I feel I walk through the world, which is constantly having to reevaluate my position within it.
Everybody's uncomfortable, but I wonder if biracial folks are particularly distraught by this play.
You know what's so funny is that like, I think it depends. I mean, again, I think it truly depends. Like, you know, one of my friends who's an actress and biracial, I think she'd feel like, fine with me telling you this, but she saw the play and it like energized her in this like really huge way. And she like went to her boyfriend that night and she's like, I don't think I want to date a white person right now. I just don't think I do.
Oh man, your art is breaking up relationships, man.
The amount of people who've broken up with their partners because of Slave Play is like insane. It's like actually crazy. But I mean, I think that like it, more so than anything, I think it woke her up to an idea, a sort of self-actualization around questions she hadn't asked herself around what she was worth inside of a relationship, inside of a country or a world that doesn't see very many places for her. I think she felt some self-actualization happen after she witnessed the play that allowed her to say, I actually think that like, this is where I want to stop with you, with this journey, you know, being with sort of like a white man from a family of like very conservative Canadians, you know? I think the people who generally have the most problems with it I've seen or I've witnessed are often just people who are like prone to be in interracial relationships for most of their life. Those are the people who seem to have the bigger complexities with it. Whereas the children of those people, I think, see a lot of things reflected in like the play that they hadn't put language to from their childhoods.
I was going to say, you've organized a few blackout performances. What is a blackout and why was it important to you to do this?
Well, a blackout is a night at the theater that is for only Black identifying audiences. I say that knowing that that's really impossible. Like the last two blackouts, there were white people who bought tickets for the play and we weren't like, get out. Didn't you see it said blacks only? You know, we were just like, oh, hey, what's up, dude? Like,
yeah, I think that's random. Against the law if you had thrown them out. Yeah, exactly. I think we have rules about that.
Yeah. It's deeply against the law. But it was quite funny because I think they're online. There's this idea that because I just said I wanted to create a safe space, an affinity space for Black people to see my play, people like there are white people online who are like, see, now if a white theater did this, you would be up in arms. I'm like, well, a white theaters do it every time I go see any play. Like you go see the Lehman trilogy and it's a whiteout. It's truly a whiteout in that audience. And I've always been the only Black person in a theater when I see plays. And I think that, you know, people forget that like it was very recently that Jim Crow laws were literally lifted from our theaters around the country, right? Like my grandmother grew up at a time when she was my age where she couldn't just go see any play she wanted because there were some theaters that wouldn't let her in. And I think that if we were going to try to rectify this like violence that was set upon like a large population in our country for like within the last 60 years, right? We have to start doing radical invitations to get those audience to feel comfortable coming back to the theater. Because it's not just about ticket prices. It's not just about location. It's not just about subject matter. Because like, look at like any Marvel movie or like before Black Panther. They all had white protagonists. And yet like Black people were going to see them in droves. Latino people were going to see them in droves. But that's because Marvel has always invited whoever wanted to come see their movie to see them, right? The theater cannot say the same of itself. And so I'm trying to do the work of re-engaging Black audiences to feel comfortable just like populating a theater the way we did in the 1920s when like the major musicals and plays and revues on Broadway were all by Black artists. Something you could read about more if you want to at a website me and my friends made called blackworkbroadway.com. God, I just plugged that so hard. But I was like, where did that come from? But like, I'm really obsessed with the theater history and when the programming of theater in America shifted from having a really rich, excited space for Black audiences, a lot of the times when they were for Black affinity plays, to like the 1980s and 90s when Black audiences sort of like teetered off from the theater and stopped feeling as invited, which I think had a lot to do with like Reagan.
In October, I talked with Ruben Santiago Hudson, and I'd been to see his play the night before, and you know, it was the first time I'd been to Broadway since the start of the pandemic, and I remembered that discomfort that I have sometimes as a Black audience member in a play that is addressing race, and sometimes there are these like, you know, moments of humor, and I'm sitting in a predominantly white space or a, you know, highly integrated space as this one was, and, you know, white folks laughing at some jokes where I really wanted to be like, nope, 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 not you right now. And I'm wondering about on nights that are not blackout nights, or maybe even more so on blackout nights where you nonetheless have white patrons, sort of what you make of the reactions of white audience members, maybe particularly to the moments of humor.
You know, it's crazy. And Melissa, I'm going to invite you to the blackout because it's really wild to see how free Black people are when they are away from the white gaze. Because I have never in my life thought that I wrote anything that might feel like a show that could go up at the Apollo or like something that like, you know, would like be akin to like the energy I felt when I was 9 years old and went to see the Kings of Comedy with my mom. And like, yet, like when I watched Slave Play with a fully black audience, it was like I had made the funniest thing that had ever existed until it wasn't. And that was wild, because oftentimes in the more mixed audiences that we have, you constantly see white people and black people checking each other to see like if it's okay for them to laugh or who's laughing and how they're laughing. And I think that like that's sort of like a great metaphor for like what moving through America is often like, you know, like sitting in that audience and that sort of integrated audience is kind of what it's like. It's like, we don't know how to dance in step with the with this person who's sort of like our forced partner. It's like we're a cotillion, and like they've like told us that like we're supposed to partner with that other person, but like neither of us really wants to dance with the other. And I feel like, you know, one of the things I like about the blackout audience is that like it's a home for black people who never felt really, really, really at home in the theater, and definitely don't feel comfortable in this like home that's not theirs, to like engage with a play like Slave Play that's asking so much of audiences, right? Mm-hmm. And whereas what I like about the nights where everyone's there is that like it, like when everyone's there, it's doing the thing the play says to do in that one stage direction, where it's not allowing anyone the chance to feel comfortable. And as much as I want to give black people as many opportunities to feel comfortable with my work as possible, I also know that the work functions better if we're in as much of a space of discomfort as possible. And I think a part of that discomfort is being like, why'd that white person laugh right there? And then that white person being like, well, why did you laugh right there? You know, and like us like trying to navigate like this history, because it's a shared history. It's not a history that one of us holds, right? And that's mm-hmm. sort of like entanglement that Slave Play is attempting to like navigate. Is like, what does it mean that we both inherited these traumas, and yet only one of us is constantly brought to the table to be like the main engager with that trauma? Like white people's engagement with the trauma of slavery is generally to say, I don't want to see that, or like that's too much, you know. And we see that all the time, right? It's like, you know, like I the amount of people who saw Slave Play said they loved Slave Play in 2019, in 2018, in 2017, and yet still were like so like, you know, destroyed, wrecked by the quote unquote racial reckoning of 2020, made me feel crazy. I was like, I thought we had already talked about a lot of this stuff. I gave you guys literally half the books that people were saying that they needed to read, that they bought and probably had, you know, collecting dust on a bookshelf somewhere because they never opened it. Those were all the books I told people to read when I did my play in 2017. I've had a resource list for my play since the play first went up in New York Theater Workshop. And yet some of those same people were still like, have you read White Fragility? Everyone must buy it now.
I'm sorry, I have to laugh because I really had to go reexamine pretty much my entire adulthood right in that moment in 2020. Because I was like, I spent a lot of time laboring really hard for like a decade, made a whole TV show every weekend. Was anyone listening? No one was listening. Okay, good, great, no problem.
I mean, like it felt like, you know, the amount of people have been like, and when I brought this up, people were like, but Jeremy, it's just so different. I'm like, but what made this different than Freddie Gray?
Yeah, no, like,
well, I mean, is this different than Ferguson? Is this different than, and you know, the only thing I can think that makes it different is that the one major character shifted. And I honestly think that people put a lot of things on George Floyd. We say his name a lot. We invoke him a lot. But I think Amy Cooper is the reason. I think that there's something really, and I think that's what Slave Play was always doing, right? With the Alana and the Jim and the Patricia and the, and the Dustin, like, you know, that this play was presenting every white Hillary voter and all of their racial blind spots, right? Like, these are not people who've done anything necessarily wrong. They just are like not listening to black people, right? They're not able to listen to their partners. And that was the core of the play that I was trying to do. And I think that's what we sort of witness white people sort of like try to wrestle with over the last year and a half. Now, I mean, I now think they have fatigue again. So I think it'll be a lot more amnesia soon, and people will have some other racial reckoning that reminds them of like their whiteness and my blackness and your blackness in 3 years. But maybe not, you know, maybe the work will keep going and we'll keep going in a good direction, but it's sometimes hard when I have people who like literally were alive during like James Baldwin and like, you know, like Martin Luther King, tell me that they don't know certain things. They didn't know certain things about the world until I wrote them in a play.
Very last one, because I can't let you out of here with just talking about the stage work. Just one beat on Zola. I think now understanding you as a double Gemini with Taurus tendencies who likes to stir the pot a bit, I understand a bit more just how wickedly weird and wonderful that film is. But talk to me a little bit about how you approach screenwriting, particularly as something that is certainly informed by your dramatic writing, but was also a very different genre.
Oh, it's a wildly different genre. And I don't think that I would have been able to endeavor it at all had I not been guided by the genius that is Janixa Bravo, right? Like Janixa was a director and writer that I admired so much. And it felt like, you know, being someone that was like obsessed with the Beatles, getting asked to play with them, right? Or like someone obsessed with Tina Turner being asked to open. Like, that's the environment I was in with her, wherein she was like, I see your talent. I think you're an amazing writer. Now let me teach you how to do it in this manner, right? Mm-hmm. And so we just like, we took our, because Janixa also was a theater maker. We took our love of theater and we brought that to how we met the text of Asia's Twitter thread. And we decided in that moment, we would not treat this Twitter thread like anything other than an epic poem or a piece of dramatic iambic pentameter, right? Mm-hmm. And so we engaged it that way, and I think that's why people feel so like electrified by our screenplay and like the film when they see it, because people don't know which way is up or which way is down. In that same way, you feel when you come out of the Royal Court Theater after seeing like a Carol Churchill play or like a new adaptation of like a Chekhov. And so having those sensibilities with the sort of the expertise of Janixa is how I was able to navigate doing my first screenplay. But I have to say, you know, screenwriting is a beast. It's a true beast. And I think that it's a beast I'm really excited to keep wrestling. I love that, like, it's beat me up, knocked the wind out of me a couple times over the last year and a half, because I can write a play in my sleep. I can beat a play. But like the sort of like financial restraints, the financial excesses, the many, many, many voices one is accountable to in film and television, makes it a really different place. And because I'm a stubborn Gemini, with Taurus tendencies, I know I'm going to keep wrestling with it for a long time until I move on to some other bigger beast.
That love of learning and running up a new learning curve with that challenge sounds like you got a little Libra in you too.
Well, I was raised by one.
Oh, there you go. There it is. Yeah. Jeremy O. Harris is the Tony-nominated playwright of Slave Play and co-screenwriter of Zola. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much, Melissa. This was amazing.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.